Today, I've got this great interview that I did with Simon Holmes a Court. Now, Simon Holmes a Court has written a personal reflection on the past election, because arguably the biggest story of the last federal election was the increase in independence in Parliament. Now, part of the reason for this was the support of Climate 200, which is an initiative of Simon Holmes a Court and others aiming to put climate policy, anti-corruption policy and equity for women on the national agenda. I spoke to Simon, as I said, about his reflections on this, which is being published by Monash University Press as part of their series In the National Interest. And this is the conversation that I had with Simon Holmes a Court about the Big Teal. So, Simon Holmes a Court, thank you very much for coming in and having a chat with us about this new In the National Interest book that's been published by Monash University Press called
The Big Teal.
Yeah, The Big Teal.
Thanks, Annie. Thanks for having me on the show.
As I was just saying to you, it's a mercifully short book in the sense that it covers a lot of ground without people having to, invest weeks of their time in it. But that's because it's a really important message, isn't it? And a very personal message.
Yeah, I wrote it in July and early August when it was still very fresh from the May 21st of May election. But with a bit of distance, I could sort of put it into context and really sort of make sense of what just happened. I think a very significant realignment of politics in Australia, and a lot of people saw it but didn't really understand what happened behind the scenes.
Yeah, I'd have to say that it's particularly important because of the nature or the tenor of the previous LNP government, because it affects a lot of the people who would naturally fall into being Liberal voters. I know that might be a gross generalisation, but it would seem that way.
Well, the movement was given a really big shot in the arm by just how bad the previous government was on a range of issues. But it also sends a big warning signal to the Liberal Party in particular that, and I think there's messages in there for Labor as well, but it sends a lot of strong signals about ignoring, what happens when you ignore an electorate and what happens when the party ideology departs from the mainstream.
Yeah, I was actually a little bit shocked by the quote that Morrison had said, "Oh, sometimes people just like to change their curtains."
Yeah, that shows he didn't get the message. And I don't know if you saw on the weekend there was the CPAC conference in Sydney, and the vice president of the Liberal Party got up and said, "Thank God we got rid of all those lefties at the election. I've been trying to get rid of them for years," and imploring the party to go further to the right. Which I think with friends like that, who needs enemies?
It's fascinating because Australians, as a general rule, you'd argue, are the masters of the middle ground.
yeah, it's actually not. I wouldn't say my hero, but John Howard put out a book very recently where he talks about exactly that Australians, we are famous for being in the middle, not, sort of Goldilocks, not too hot, not too cold, just right. Liberal implies that you're easygoing, the original meaning of the word, not how it's come. So I think Australians don't see themselves as warriors on most Australians don't see themselves as warriors on either end of the spectrum. We live in a pretty comfortable place in the middle where we tolerate a fair bit of opinion, but most of us are not as extreme as some of the parties are going.
Now, you obviously come from an illustrious economic background, as in the Holmes a Court. Your father was an extraordinarily clever businessman, and your mother as well, a business person. So you've seen how the machine of power operates. That's really the point I'm getting at. So you know about the what happens behind the scenes, in a sense.
I've certainly seen mediocrity promoted far beyond merit. And, you know, it's been, I have been very privileged to be exposed to a lot of uncommon experiences, I guess, and had a great education. But I write a bit about this in the book. That,
well, that's why I bring it up.
I went to a very exclusive school,
but a frightening one.
Oh, at the time, I've got to give it. The sort of hope that things have reformed a lot. But in the 80s, Geelong Grammar was a pretty awful place, as we saw. Just one microcosm of it was the Royal Commission into the Institutional Responses to Child Sex Abuse, where the school came off particularly poorly. But that was just one angle. It was part of a culture, a dehumanising culture of the boarding school. So I learnt there that you can call yourself the best and actually be very mediocre. You can have the sons and daughters of the establishment who would receive privilege, a leg up beyond way beyond others, and not appreciate that or not use it for not feel any obligation to look at the societal impacts of what they do.
Yeah, exactly. But you say that in your efforts to get climate and change towards a positive outcome in this area, that you were really surprised to find that professional relationships where loyalty trumped reasoned opinion.
Absolutely, that was one of the things I learned in the political process, that networks of obligation that come about from loyalty and supporting each other advancing, rather than a passion to do the right thing. I had this model when I first started getting involved in politics. I mean, I got involved in politics. I helped a number of organisations with their advocacy, where they'd do a bunch of work to work out what's the right energy path for Australia or some other environmental cause. You do a whole bunch of work, you take it up to Canberra. And I had this model that you take good ideas up to Canberra and they would grab them with both hands and say, thank you very much, we've been looking for this, and they'd go away and do it. And I discovered that that's not how it works. A great cynic, friend and mentor, Richard Dennis, told me once that the two best ways to get a politician to do something is not reason, it's pain and fear of pain. That's what motivates. It's pretty cynical, but for so many politicians, that's what motivates them. Is how do I avoid this thing that's going to get in my path, what can I do to get rid of the thing that's in my path right now, rather than how can I make the world a better place, or how can I evidence-based policy is nowhere near as powerful as career boosting,
very short term stuff.
Very short term, and not short term for the country, but short term for personal ambition.
That's right. And when we're in an existential crisis, that's a bit worrying, isn't it?
The crises get ignored if you're just thinking about the next election, or you're thinking about your career and your pathway to the top.
Now, as I said, this book is actually a very personal testament, and you tell us about you tell us about this really great things that you've actually worked on. So
Hepburn Wind Farm.
Yeah, that was a fantastic story. Tell people about that.
So,
and what you learned.
So I came, and it's the same with this community independence movement. I wasn't there at the beginning. About 2004, I think it was, a wind farm company had an idea to build a wind farm not far from Daylesford, and they held a town hall meeting on the evening. A car full of people from Daylesford went along to it. They turned up to what they thought was going to be an information session, and it was practically a lynching, is how they described it. There were people who had come from all over the state to tell this wind farm company, you're not building those wind turbines here. It was very early on in the wind industry. There was lots of misinformation that the wind farms would make you sick, or that they would kill every brolga within 1,000 kilometres, or some of them were genuinely
unsightly.
Yeah, but a lot of it was was tied up with climate denial as well. It was a pretty ugly meeting, and the developer was basically run out of town. There was a Daylesford local who was there that night, Pierre Bernard, Danish fellow, who he'd grown up in Denmark, where there are wind farms all around, and they're largely community owned, whether it's your local council or a farmer or just a cooperative of people who pitch in together and build a wind farm. So he thought, why don't we do that in Daylesford? And it took him about, well, it took about 3 years for him to get a core group of people together. He managed to convince me to join. And I went along to the meeting. When there's about 300 people who wanted to build the project, they had a town hall meeting. I went along to it and put my hand up to get involved, and I accidentally came out as the chairman of the group. Took us a long time, took us 3 years to put the money together to build it. But there are two turbines named Gale and Gusto up on the hill, 10 kilometres south of Daylesford, and they put as much clean energy, much electricity into the grid every year as Daylesford, Hepburn Springs, and most of the houses all around there will use in an average year. So it's basically offset the town from an electricity perspective. And they keep going. They're putting solar and a battery in soon. They've been helping with bulk buy of electric vehicles. It's now called Hepburn Energy, and it's great just to see it going from strength to strength. But that was the first project I did.
I just find that really fascinating, and this has led you to an equally practical approach with Climate 200 to try and influence the democratic process, because you've got quite a few things that you've learned out of this, haven't you?
Yeah, so yeah, Hepburn was where I learnt how, when community... We often, people think of communities as being as being amateurs, but actually, we all live in the community, and there are experts everywhere. And with the Hepburn project, we found amazing people locally that had all the range of skills that were needed to pull together and build the project. I mean, obviously, we brought in construction and specialist skills from outside. But we had people who knew how to get this up and going.
Or even when you had stumbled. A person with the expertise of how to present the idea came
yes.
on board.
Yeah, that was the mother.
That was pivotal.
The mother of a school friend of one of my kids came and when the project really we struggled in our fundraising during the financial crisis, and it was this friend from within the community said, "Oh, I know how to get people's confidence back in the project," and she helped us with the comms plan, and we got it together. And rather than the project folding, she got we built the confidence, and we did it. Much the same way. When I saw the community independence campaign or community independence movement first when I watched Cathy McGowan, and then later Helen Haynes and the independents around her. People often forget this, but for the first 7 months or so of Morrison's prime ministership, he had a minority government with a crossbench. Julia Banks, if you remember, moved from she took off her liberal colours and became an independent. Karen Phelps took over Wentworth after Malcolm Turnbull was dumped, and joining with a number of other independents on the crossbench, they managed to get up the Medivac legislation, which was provided a pathway for refugees in offshore detention to get medical attention that they had previously been denied. So it was the most humane development in refugee policy from Parliament in a decade, really. And that was led by independents. And I saw that up close. I accidentally, again, got involved in a campaign, but I saw how the independents could be both the backbone and the conscience of Parliament. And it wasn't a period of dysfunction. It was a highly... productive on that front on that issue, and they didn't get in the way of anything. And then I saw through the last parliament that Helen Haynes kept the idea of an integrity commission alive. And we definitely talk about the importance of that. But I also saw Zali Steggall keep the 2030, the idea of a 2030 target and a net zero alive. Both of those. Outstanding local representatives, both independent, managed to exert a lot of soft power that I think you can draw a straight line from that to the National Anti-Corruption Commission that we're about to have legislated in the next, well, should go through the lower house in the coming weeks. And for the 43% by 2030 target that was legislated just a month ago under the new government, both of those initiatives, you can draw a straight line from the community independent candidates who kept those issues alive when the major parties had wished they would those issues would fade away into the background.
G'day, my name is Margie Thorpe. You are listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 on your dial.
And you're with Annie on Solidarity Breakfast, and we're having a conversation with Simon Holmes of Court. This is around a personal reflection that he's made in regards to the Climate 200's work in the last election called The Big Teal. It's being published by Monash University Press as part of their series In the National Interest. It's such a fascinating conversation. We'll continue. Climate 200, the reason for why 200, you know, it's a classic targeting process. Mm. You say it's about the climate and I want 200 people to put their hat in the ring with some money so that we can help targeted independents with their campaigns.
Yes, and I've got to say that it's in political fundraising, there are lots of 200 clubs around. There's a Kooyong 200, which raises money for the Liberal member for Kooyong previously. There's, I think, a Menzies and a Q500. They have this common thing where you have the name of the electorate with a number after it, and the number is, initially at least, was the goal of how many people. So Climate 200, we were trying to get 200 people who would contribute to getting candidates in Parliament that were going to fight for climate.
In fact, in the book, if people want to know how this is actually done, practically speaking, you really should read The Big Teal, because you are very practical. You tell people how exactly you did the snowball effect of fundraising, which is a very important tool. But I want to get to the first off, you tried it and was less successful, and then you did it again, right?
So yeah, in 2019, I had the idea, but I had it late. So we started Climate 200 6 weeks before the 2019 election. We didn't get to 200 people. We only got to about 28. So, you know, well short. But we did raise $500,000. So people were, you know, I managed to tap some people who were quite generous. And
also thought that this was important.
They thought it was important. There are a few campaigns that we helped. There were some campaigns that we threw money at that we learned afterwards we're never going to go anywhere. And so we learned the difficulties of supporting Senate candidates in the large states. We learned the importance of coming in early. 6 weeks before the election is not enough time. You need to plan these things out months in advance and have things, you know, have the campaign expenditure all booked in well before then. But it was an important learning experience. But when we relaunched I launched it again in 2021. This time I tried to launch it with a year's runway. And, we did a review
that was going to say, you did something very important. You employed the right people. You did a thing that Keating was very good at, getting the right people and giving them their head, right? Get them, allowed them to do their job.
Yes, I found two people. Byron Fay, who was in Senator Tim Storer's office, and then he went across to work on Joe Biden's campaign. So he understood independence, and he also understood campaigning and the latest tactics, I guess, from the US. And I also engaged Anthony Reid, who was Karen Phelps' campaign manager when she won Wentworth in the 2018 by-election in Wentworth. And he also is the campaign manager for Zali Steggall in 2019. He really knows what he's doing and how to campaign. He also knows how to keep his head when things are stressful and you're under attack. Both of which turned, you know, those skills turned out to be very, very important later on. But in early 2021, I engaged them both to go out and write a report for me. They went and talked to everyone we supported. They went and talked to a bunch of donors who had given. They talked to political experts. And they also did a bunch of research on this new community independence movement. Well, it's not that new. Kathy McGowan started in 2012 up in Indi when at least I should say the people of Indi started it, and they chose Kathy to run against Sophie Mirabella, and they won. Mm. And she won again in 2016. In 2019, she handed over to Helen Haynes. So it's the first time that an independent has passed a seat to another independent. So there have always been independents in Australia, but what makes this movement different is that it's the community that first stands up and says, we want something different. We want to be, you know, the party system's not working for us. We're being taken for granted. We want to find someone with our values who's not just part of a great big machine. And they went out and they chose first Cathy McGowan and then later Helen Haynes. And that same model, people said, oh, that could only work in a country area. But when they took it to some people from Warringah saw it, and they did it in their own way. Warringah's, I think Warringah's in, it's definitely in the top decile of, you know, maybe in the top five richest electorates in the country, and Indi's in, you know, is much lower down. So people thought, oh, it's just culturally, the community doesn't work. But it turned out that they found their, you know, they did it in a very Warringah way, but it worked really well. And Zali just increased her primary in her, and came back with a stronger, you know, stronger primary in her second election. So this model's got legs. You know, we saw, you know, both Zali and Helen win in 2019, joining Andrew Wilkie and Rebecca Sharkey. So we had four people on the crossbench, all of whom are strong on climate and integrity. And our goal was to find the communities that were going down this pathway, find ones that had what it took to win, but our review,
and who were engaged with their communities.
Yeah. I mean,
you didn't actually orchestrate this.
No. As we're saying before, there's I mean, lots of people have tried starting parties before. It's really, really difficult, and you get.
I mean, it's like trying to start a union.
Right. And you spend most of your time on internal fights rather than trying to convince the voters. But this model was sort of almost like anti-politics. It was, you know, as in the opposite of politics, that people didn't start out with partisan, are you left or you're right. They started out with this process that was honed in Indi, kitchen table conversations, where you'd sit down with people and say, well, what do we agree on? What are our central values? Forget about parties. Forget about, you know, teams that you've previously been, you know, worn the jersey for. What are the shared values? And people found out that actually shared values and their desire for what they want in the community was a lot of common ground. And I think it's been one of the exciting
That's
things
really
about this
interesting,
movement.
Isn't
that
it?
It's, yeah, that that it's not coming from the left. It's not coming from the right. It's coming from the shared values, which, you know, I guess can only be called centre.
Oh, and also it's not old and it's not young. It's all people.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. So we saw this movement growing. We saw it had been successful, and that there were. It was February 2021. Cathy McGowan ran a conference, and there were 300 people from, I think it was 72 electorates, turned up to this online Zoom conference, raring to go. And we kept in touch with a bunch of groups that we met at that conference. And when they started getting ahead of steam, when you've got the right people around, you need the people who are going to run the campaign before you have the candidate. You need people who understand politics, but people understand community, people really well connected into the community. You need organisers. And then only once you've got that together is it worth going out and trying to find the candidate. And if the campaign is candidate-led rather than community-led, I just think it doesn't work that often. If it's community-led, we just saw at the federal election just how powerful it was with six in the lower house and one in the Senate being added.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And you also learned a whole range of other things about one of the reasons why it was so important for you to actually support campaigns financially and with expertise, I guess, was how entrenched the model of the electoral system in Australia really is, geared towards same.
Yeah, absolutely. there are so many benefits for incumbents, and so the playing field is tilted so far. And I talk in the book about a few things, like if you want to make a donation to a major party today, it's tax deductible. If you want to donate to an independent, it only becomes tax deductible 4 weeks before election. Again, major parties have access to the electoral roll anytime they want.
That's really fascinating to me.
Yeah, whereas an independent can't get it until 4 weeks before the election, in which case it's too late. You need to be out on the ground long before then. So they have to go out and buy. You can buy a commercial copy of the roll, but it costs you $40,000. So there's so many benefits. And the parties receive everyone receives money per vote after the election. But if you're an upstart, you're not established, so you don't have a cent in the bank. You don't have an office. So all of these things work to shut people out. What we did is find
and as you point out, the Constitution doesn't actually include party
There's
politics.
There's no mention of the parties at all in the Constitution. It was not, I think there's a strong argument that the system we've ended up with was not the design, the original intention of the design. It's just worked that way because, and to a certain extent, it's a duopoly where they agree on rules to entrench themselves, and that certainly happened in Victoria. We saw a great piece in the Age 10 days ago where Chip LeGrand, the sort of political investigative journalist, put out a piece that the major parties have created $100 million publicly funded wall around elections that if you're an outsider you don't have any access to. You've got to fundraise separately to have a hope in hell to get over that wall, but they've put fundraising limits on, so it's incredibly hard to get over. It's possible, and I think we're going to see some independents perform well at the state election, but they're up against a system that's been designed by the majors, and coincidentally it locks out challengers.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's why it was so important that that this was an effective challenge, what's happened in the last election.
Yeah, so that was our job, was to level the playing field so that you could have a go. And, we clearly managed to do so in 7 races. But I think what's really exciting is there are a number of other races that came close. People love volunteering for these campaigns. They love the look at the loyalty that is towards Helen Haynes up in Indi, Orzali, in Warringah, and people are excited about politics and their politician again. I experienced a bit of the Kooyong campaign. I live in Kooyong, and the volunteers just loved it. They absolutely loved working on the campaign, and then to have such a thumping win. So many people, it was the most rewarding community thing they've done, and they can't wait to do it again. So I think there's a lot of possibility of this model going further. There were 6 races where the independent came a close second, but didn't win in this last election. So if they just do a little bit extra, a little bit more, and a few others work, a few other communities jump in, we could easily see double the number on the crossbench.
I was fascinated by some of the people that you mentioned in your piece who put money in. They are the Milgrams, for example, not because they did, but because they are so clear-sighted about the importance of climate policy, but also democracy, because our democracy was under threat.
Yeah, very, very much. Actually, I was talking to some philanthropists recently, and one of them said something that really struck me. They said, "Democracy is a climate strategy," and I hadn't thought of that before. That, if our democracy is not working, we can't fix anything.
No, we can't.
So increasingly, philanthropists are seeing that now. Climate 200, we had 11,200 donors. We had donors from each one of the 151 electorates in Australia, and a third of our donors were rural and regional. But we did have some big family names, Milgram, Fairfax, and there some other big names. And what one thing I'm seeing, in a number of families, that's that intergenerational transfer, wealth transfer, where the second or third generation is actually really passionate about these issues. They're passionate about climate, they're passionate about integrity, and they might have a whole lot of other things as well. But they, democratic reform and, rooting out corruption from our democracy and actually doing stuff on climate is a real passion for the second generation. It was really, really heartening for me to meet with many people from what you'd call the establishment, and their values are very much aligned with the values Climate 200 had of climate integrity and treatment and safety of women.
Yeah, well, that was interesting. The treatment of women was an important element to this as well. It's about balancing everything, a balance in society. One of the things I did want to ask you is, why did you do this?
Well, I'd been trying to get action on climate change for a long time, and I started accidentally with that Hepburn Wind project, and I really enjoyed it. And I did lots of advocacy after the project, and we helped many other communities build mainly solar farms. There's something like, I think last count I saw was about 60 community solar farms popped up around the country.
This is a decentralisation model, which is interesting as well.
Decentralisation. There was a phrase that kept coming up in Climate 200, which I think back as to why community energy projects felt so good as well. It's called, someone used this phrase from the McKellar campaign, active hope. They said you can sit at home and complain about, back then the Morrison government, or you can sit and complain about the Murdoch media, or you can have hope, but if the hope isn't backed with anything, it does feel pretty empty, or you're going to get disappointed. But if you're out there, if you are working to get someone elected and you know that they're going to go to Canberra and follow your values, then it's hope, and you're playing a part in realising that hope. And so I think the Hepburn Wind project was my first experience with active hope. There's the sense of achievement from literally thousands of people who made that project possible. There's a lot of parallels with that and the community independence movement, which is really... it's really about democratic revival, of re-engaging with democracy. I couldn't be happier with what's, how the movement is developing and the performance of those great, strong community independents that have gone to Canberra.
Yeah, that's great. The other thing you reminded me was that as you were becoming more successful in this process, various culture warriors came out with barbed attacks on you. it was fascinating to see the litany of things that, step-by-step-by-step things, even down to calling you anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
That's classic.
That was the lowest blow that they struck, I think, during the campaign. But it's funny, people... throughout the campaign, friends would call me. I was mercilessly attacked by Sky After Dark and by The Australian and by The Herald Sun and Telegraph. But the rest of the media was pretty benign. So it was a very clear, orchestrated attack. And I would quite often see this, there'd be an article posted on one of the News Corp sites, and 3 minutes later, one of the MPs who was under attack from a community leader, they would tweet it out and say what an awful person I was. And you could just see that this very cozy relationship between News Corp and the Liberal Party. I mean, in fact, I know it's a bit of a cliche to say it, but
to see it in front of your eyes.
To see it and feel that I don't know, is the Liberal Party the political arm of the News Corp media, or is News Corp the propaganda arm of the Liberal Party? They are an incredible machine to watch, and I felt it firsthand. The good thing was that I was a lightning rod, leaving the candidates to go and...
That's interesting.
They got through to the election spotless, I think.
That's a tactic in itself.
Yeah, and it was. I mean, it was almost like I was a decoy, right? Yeah. But it wasn't very smart of them, because I wasn't even running. I wasn't looking for votes.
They seem to think that you were working against your class.
Yeah, no, I had there was one News Corp journalist who painted me as a class traitor, right? That I don't think I've ever heard anyone in Australia use that phrase, that kind of phrase. Yeah, so, and I had a lot of well-meaning friends call up and say, oh, I'm really sorry for the treatment you're getting in the media, but honestly, it was so ridiculous that it didn't hurt. The confected claims of anti-Semitism were
it's pretty appalling.
Was appalling, but I think we've got to call it out. That I think that making up an accusation of anti-Semitism and throwing it at someone does a lot of disrespect to the Jewish people, to the Holocaust. If you try to cheapen that experience for political gain, I think that's disgusting, and it should be called out. And there are some people who I think should be facing a reckoning for it wasn't just against me, it was against about six MPs. There was this campaign run where they made up these things to try to turn the Jewish populations and I think the progressive populations against the candidates. That was the lowest point of the campaign.
Mm, yeah. Well, I'm glad the electorate was hardy enough to see through it.
Yeah, I think that's reassuring, right? That as the News Corp tried everything they could do to stop this movement, and it was a thumping success. So maybe there's a crack of light that they've lost their power with a significant part of the electorate. And I've got three.
They reform. I can tell you, they just reform.
They just reform, shapeshift into. I've got three children of voting age, and they don't have any exposure to that media.
No, exactly right.
So it's almost as if the claws that media has on the population into fewer and fewer people as the years go by. Let's hope, because they've certainly forfeited their right, I think, to have such a grip on the narratives in Australia.
Well, thank you very much for writing this, The Big Teal, and it's great that Monash University Press has put it out as part of the national interest, which it is.